Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program, hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and by WonderFest, the Bay Area Beacon of Science. My name is Tucker Hyatt. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Martin Rees, astronomer royal and author of On the Future, Prospects for Humanity. Dr. Rees has been director of the Institute of Astronomy at Cambridge University and a master of Trinity College, Cambridge. He is a member of the United Kingdom's House of Lords and a former president of the Royal Society. Dr. Rees has spent much of his career involved in international science. He has received numerous awards for his professional and societal contributions, including the Gold Medal of the Royal Astronomical Society and the Isaac Newton Medal from the Institute of Physics. Someday, perhaps, such outstanding medal winners, such as Lord Rees, will have the metals for their medals mined on the asteroid which has been named in his honor, asteroid 4587 Rees. Moderating this evening's event is Alison von Diggelen, BBC contributor and host of Fresh Dialogues. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Lord of the UK and the asteroid 4587 Rees, Dr. Martin Rees and Alison von Diggelen.
Martin Rees, we're delighted to have you here in Silicon Valley to help us explore the challenges that humanity faces, as well as inspire us to find and support solutions to those threats.
It's great to be here.
I'm glad. Mm. So tonight I'd like to focus more on the solutions than the threats.
Yes.
We want to leave here tonight feeling inspired about solutions. Oh.
That's asking a lot. Yeah.
But first, I'd love you to explain your title. You have quite an unusual title, certainly to the American ear. You are the Astronomer Royal. What does that mean and what does it not mean?
Well, it's a rather antique title, and in fact, the Astronomer Royal was the person who used to run the Greenwich Observatory. It was set up in 1675, and he was really the first government-funded scientist of any kind, because, of course, astronomy was important for the calendar, navigation, etc. And that was the job of the Astronomer Royal until the 1960s. But then it became possible to have telescopes, not under the cloudy skies of London, but to travel to Canary Islands, Hawaii, and Chile, which is where we have our telescopes now. And then the Greenwich Observatory became a museum, and they kept the title, but they made it a sort of honorary title, given to some senior academic astronomer. I like to say the duties are so exiguous, I can do them posthumously. I need never give up. if I can tell one anecdote, I'm sometimes confused with an astrologer. And I once, at the Davos conference, I met an Indian tycoon. And he said, "Do you do the Queen's horoscopes?" And I said, "Well, if she wanted one, I'm the man she'd ask." And he took this seriously. And I played along and I said, I predict the stock market will fluctuate. I predict trouble in the Middle East and other insightful thoughts like that. He nodded sagely. But I then came clean and I said, "Actually, I'm just a scientist." And then he lost all interest in my predictions, and rightly so, because scientists are rotten forecasters, not quite as bad as economists, but nearly as bad.
It's a great story.
So that's the answer to
it's a great story.
This, yes.
So in your book, On the Future, you explore a multitude of threats,
right,
from climate change to asteroids.
Yes, and here's the book. Yeah.
It's a beautiful little book that covers a lot of territory, and I'm hoping that we can cover a lot of it tonight. Mm-hmm. But what I want to ask to start this off, what is our biggest existential threat? What is it that keeps you awake at night? You're aware of all these threats.
Yes. Well, it depends what, I mean, existential threats in the sense of killing everyone off are most unlikely. So I don't take those too seriously. But I think we'll have a bumpy ride through this century for various reasons, which I discuss in my book. It depends what time scale. If you think of the next 10 or 20 years, I think we are going to have lots of social disruption through misuse of cyber tech and biotech. We already know about how disruptive cyber attacks can be, and ditto will happen with bio. And so on that time scale, I worry about the new fact that small numbers of people are empowered by technology to cause massive disruption. I think this is very, very serious. I don't know how we can cope with it, because we can have regulations, but we can't enforce them globally. So that's the issue on the short time scale. On the longer time scale, of course, we have to worry about environmental threats of two kinds. I mean, possibly the climate crossing tipping points, and also loss of biodiversity if our growing population impacts too greatly. So I think it depends on what time scale you ask. But I think we're going to have a bumpy ride through the century. And another point is that clearly we have to worry about the huge disparities and inequalities, not so much within nations, but between nations. And perhaps we come back to it later, but I think Africa is a special problem because it is lagging behind the rest of the world, and it'll be hard for it to get out of poverty. That's partly because it won't have the ladder that was available to the East Asian countries of undercutting manufacturing costs in the West, because robots can do that. So it won't have that. And so it's going to be hard for it to get out of poverty, especially if the population keeps on growing. And the other concern is that, unlike 50 years ago, Africans may not have toilets, but they do have mobile phones. So they know what they're missing. They know how unfair their situation is. And unless we do something about that, that's really a recipe for massive international disturbances and mega versions of the boat people coming across the Mediterranean, which are already, of course, a serious concern. So it's in everyone's interest to ensure that Africa can develop. That was a slightly sideline from your general issue, but just to illustrate that we have to worry about the misuse of powerful technologies, which allow a small number of people to have a massive effect. We need to worry about the impact of a growing human population on the planet, its environment and its climate. And we have to worry about disruptive effects due to perceived inequalities.
That's a lot of worries.
Yeah.
So let's explore climate change. You write, under business as usual scenarios in which the world continues to depend on fossil fuels, we can't rule out later this century catastrophic warming and tipping points triggering long-term trends like the melting of Greenland's ice cap. Can you expand on that and the implications for food supply, mass migration, etc.?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think this is so well understood and so well known that I won't say much about it. I think we all know that fossil fuels are leading to CO2, which is causing the temperature to rise. And the temperature rise is just an indication of changes in global weather patterns. We don't know how fast these are because there's an uncertainty in the sort of feedback effects, uncertainty in how cloud cover and water vapor changes. So we know there's an uncertainty in the science and an uncertainty in the other projections. But I think everyone knows that on some of the projections, we were getting into dangerous territory under business as usual by the end of a century. And that, of course, is the motive for the Paris Climate Conference and all this. Now, if you ask me what we're going to do about it, then, of course, as you know, there's a discussion of carbon taxes and all that sort of thing. I'm pessimistic about those being politically acceptable because it's very hard to get politicians, whose focus is normally on the local and the short term, to care about something which is going to affect mainly people in remote parts of the world 50 years from now. That's very hard. So what I say in my book is that the one win-win situation is to enhance research and development into all forms of carbon-free energy. And I include nuclear power in this. Because if we can accelerate the research and development into clean energy and all the things that go with it, energy storage, batteries, and DC grids spanning continents, all these things, then we will be able to persuade everyone it's better to have clean energy. And if the cost of clean energy comes down, then in India, for instance, where at the moment they don't have enough energy and they have smoky stoves burning wood and dung in people's homes very unhealthily, and they are obviously in need of a national grid, and they're going to build lots of coal-fired power stations unless the alternative is cheaper. So I would say that we need R&D on the scale of defence research or medical research to really develop optimum clean energy and its appurtenances, so that the countries that develop it will have a bonanza in selling it to the rest of the world, and countries like India will be able to leapfrog directly to clean energy. And that, I think, is the only way that we can envisage a scenario where the carbon dioxide concentration never gets up to a dangerous level.
Right, and you say in your book we should be evangelists for these new clean energy technologies to fight climate change. Which ones do you think have the greatest potential, and who's the most effective evangelist today?
Well, obviously we know that it's wind and solar, which overall are the most effective, but there are local ones. There's geothermal, there's hydropower, and all these things, and we want to develop them all. But we need a transcontinental grid. We need it to go east-west in this country to smooth over peak demands in different time zones, and one hopes the Chinese, as part of their Belt and Road Initiative, will do a similar thing all the way from China to Europe for the same reason. And we need one north-south to carry solar energy from the sunny south to northern areas. So we need a grid, and we need that whatever renewables we depend on. I also think we need better storage, obviously, better batteries, but I think the most important thing is that we should not give up on nuclear energy. The trouble with nuclear energy is, I think, in this country, there hasn't been a nuclear power station commissioned for the last 20 or 30 years, and the designs date from the 1960s, so I think we need to have research and development into all kinds of fourth-generation nuclear power designs, especially so-called small modular reactors, which can be manufactured in a factory and standardized to bring down the cost of nuclear power, because I think that's a real alternative. And, of course, the situation is that you need some sort of base load, unless you have a huge storage, in order to provide power during long, cold and calm spells. And so I think nuclear should be part of this R&D. But my main message is we need an expansion urgently of research and development to all kinds of clean energy, and that'll be a bonanza for those who develop it, and that'll be good for the world. And I think it's a very inspiring goal for young engineers to try and provide clean and affordable, sustainable energy for the developing and the developed world.
Are you not concerned about scenarios like Fukushima on the nuclear area?
Of course I am. And so that's why we don't need to necessarily use these designs from the 1960s. And they had not, they'd done some number of things wrong. They didn't have a high enough wall to cope with a tsunami. And they put their emergency generators so low down they got flooded, etc. So I think we do need to be concerned. But on the other hand, I do think that the concern about radiation levels is exaggerated, because in the case of Fukushima, they evacuated people in a way, and I think more people died through the evacuation than would have died if they'd stayed put. I mean, if I was an old villager near Fukushima, I would rather accept a somewhat higher risk of cancer and live out my days in my own home than be evacuated. And I think there are lots of examples I can give where there's been an exaggerated concern about low radiation levels. And I say in my book that there should be rediscussion and better guidelines about what to do if there's a dirty bomb or if there's a similar accident, so that we don't make the problem worse by an excessive evacuation.
And what's your attitude to geoengineering?
Geoengineering, yes. Geoengineering is the idea that we can actually counteract the global warming by some technology, by, for instance, putting some particles in the upper atmosphere, which will stop a certain percentage of the sunlight going to the ground. Now, this is feasible, but the trouble is you can't really predict the consequences. We don't understand the atmosphere well enough to know exactly what would happen if you put this in. And of course, it could be done. It's actually surprisingly cheap. One nation, even one corporation, could put enough stuff into your atmosphere to change the world's climate. And, of course, if this came about, if it was a policy, then there'd be a new kind of international disputes because different countries would want to turn down the thermostat differently. Mm-hmm. And the only beneficiaries would be the lawyers, because if nations could litigate about bad weather, then this would be a new arena for lawyers, and they would be the only beneficiaries. But I think we would have to worry about geoengineering because there would be a problem of getting agreement. There's a second kind of geoengineering which is more benign, and that's simply somehow sucking the excess carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And the ways of doing this, one way is to have some complicated mechanical setup, and the other way is to grow lots of trees, burn them, and then sequester the carbon they produce. Now, this has been discussed, and there's a National Academy of Sciences report just recently on these ideas, and they are they're not easy. You have to find a way of storing billions of tons of carbon dioxide every year, and that's not a doddle. That's a big problem. So I think geoengineering is possible, but I can't really imagine it being done in a big way.
I'm curious to get your insights on priorities. Today, CERN, the European Research Lab for Particle Physics, announced it's planning an accelerator 4 times longer and 10 times more powerful than the existing circular collider. Yes. Critics say that money is better spent on research for combating climate change. What do you think?
Well, I think they're not in the same compartment. I mean, one is pure science, one is applied science. I'm not sure I would... I think it's going to be the Chinese who build the next big accelerator, actually. I think that. But I think, Europe built the world's best accelerator in CERN, and it's cost, I think, between $5 and $10 billion. And people say, isn't this a lot? But it's contributed over 20 years by about 20 countries, and it's actually taking up about 2% of the science budget of those countries. And looked at that way, I think it's not unreasonable that 2% of the science budget is spent on what everyone agrees is a fundamental area of science. And so I don't think it should be seen in competition. There are a lot of other ways in which we can get more money for climate research, and I certainly think we do need more climate research, and this means not only more data, which we get from satellites, but also more powerful computers to do better simulations. And I think I heard in this country there was a move not to replace your existing climate monitoring satellites, and that would be a real false economy, because I think when you had the hurricane that hit New York, if it hadn't been forecast, the damage would have been billions of dollars greater, which would have been a much bigger sum than the cost of the satellites themselves. So it's good value to have these satellites.
Yes, and that brings me on to political will to take action. We have the technology to become a renewable clean energy economy here in the United States, but talk about political will and what needs to change to, you know, turn that lever.
Well, of course, there can be incentive, but I think obviously the innovation which we're going to need to get clean energy for the world is going to come mainly from the private sector, but it's got to be stimulated by the government, and of course government laboratories can be part of that. So I think obviously it does depend on having the right incentives in play, and that's certainly lacking in the case of energy at the moment.
Yes. So let's discuss innovation. You write, in the context of discovering new energy sources, innovation is often hazardous, but if we don't take risks, we may forgo benefits. Talk about the precautionary principle and the hidden cost of saying no to new technology.
Yes. Well, this is, I think, a well-known thing, because all new technologies do involve risks. when the first steam engines were developed, lots of boilers exploded and people were killed, etc. And every medical procedure and every surgical operation is risky when it's introduced and benefits people in the longer run. So there's always this trade-off between riskiness in the early stage of any innovation and the long-term benefits, and we have to have this balance. And what's called the precautionary principle is the principle that we should not do anything if it has uncertain possible downsides. And there's something to be said for that in a way, but on the other hand, if this is taken to extreme, then you never do anything. And I think there's been an issue in particular in the case of genetically modified foods. And this is one context where the US has been more relaxed than Europe. The European Union has a very strict application of this precautionary principle, which leads them to prohibit GM crops. Whereas here, you use them, and of course, in Europe, we tell people that there's been this huge experiment done on 300 million people over here eating this stuff for 30 years with no obvious bad effects. And so we ought to say the effects aren't too bad. But that's an example where in Europe we carry the precautionary principle too far. But on the other hand, if you're a biologist and you're tinkering with the influenza virus, then I quote in my book cases where they did find it was surprisingly easy to make it more virulent and more transmissible, and that's a potentially dangerous kind of experiment, and indeed your federal government quite rightly stopped funding that experiment just because it was indeed so dangerous. So there's a balance to be struck between where you think the risks are acceptable and where the risks are too great to justify doing the thing in the first place.
Great. So talk more generally about how to encourage innovation and science breakthroughs and the importance of questioning, you know, teaching young people to question the status quo and break the rules. Do you have rules for breaking the rules?
I don't think so, but of course, if I speak as in way my hat as a professor, we know very well that in order to encourage innovation, good ideas, then you've got to have a university which is organized in a way that gives people intellectual freedom and encourages risk-taking and gives them a longer time scale so they can plan, etc. So we can look back in the past and see where the innovations have come from. We can see they've come from groups engaged in freewheeling research. And these may be groups which are in universities or maybe in the public sector. I'll give you two examples. I'm in Cambridge, and the Laboratory of Medical Biology is a fairly small lab which has won 19 Nobel Prizes. And that's always had a style of fairly freewheeling research where people get funded. They don't have to apply for grants all the time, and that works. But on the other hand, there's a book that came out recently by a British economist called The Entrepreneurial State, which makes the point that many of the innovations that are crucial in Silicon Valley were publicly funded. They were funded for the military and early lasers and computer chips and many other things. They were developed by the public sector, where big national labs allowed this sort of freedom and long-term planning. So we need to have that atmosphere of long-term planning so that you can seize on some unpredictable idea and run with it without having to justify yourself every year.
But what about that issue of questioning authority? How do you instill that in young people, do you think?
Well, I think by not being too authoritative, really. Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about one of the major threats you talk about in your book, inequality. You write, the plight of the bottom million in today's world...
Billion.
Billion, did I say?
I said million, yeah.
Okay, let's start again.
Yeah.
You're right, the plight of the bottom billion in today's world could be transformed by redistributing the wealth of the 1,000 richest people on the planet.
Yes.
Can you expand on...
Well, I mean, if you work out the numbers, that is true. The income from the money owned by those 1,000 people would double the income of the billion people living on a dollar a day. I'm not saying that's the best thing to do. There may be other ways in which the wealthy can help the world's poor, but there are these huge inequalities, obviously, which are festering. And as I say, in Africa, they're going to fester even more because everyone in Africa is aware of how disadvantaged they are. Bill Gates sets a fine example of redistributing wealth in a creative way, but not enough follow his example. And I think it's not just the ultra-rich. I think we need to redistribute wealth in order to encourage the right kind of employment. And if I can switch to a slightly different topic, which we haven't brought up yet, the consequences of AI and machines replacing certain kinds of work. We know that machines are going to take over some kinds of manufacturing. Not all blue-collar jobs. Gardening and plumbing will be very hard to mechanize. But many professional jobs like radiologists and lawyers and computer coders can be mechanized. And, of course, we have to ask what's going to happen to those jobs. And my solution there is that there needs to be massive redistribution from the owners of the robot, as it were, to create lots of jobs where the human element is crucial. For instance, carers for old people, teaching assistants, custodians at public parks, and things of that kind. And I think I could see this happening in Scandinavia, where they have a welfare state. I think it's less likely to happen here because there may be the reluctance to have this massive redistribution. But I think this would be benign because the jobs being created, which would make caring for old people more dignified and more respected and provide enough people to do it for everyone, not just for the rich, these jobs are frankly more dignified for a human being than working in an Amazon warehouse or working in a call center, for instance, which are the jobs that are going to be replaced. So I think there's a win-win situation there. You can generate from the wealth earned by the machines more jobs where human beings are crucially better than machines, namely looking after the old.
Right. And I'd like to get back to the whole inequality and how the internet is enforcing echo chambers, reinforcing radical views, national and religious loyalties. What solutions do you see to that negative effect of the internet?
Well, you're talking about encouraging extremists.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think, of course, the plus of the internet is that you can communicate with people anywhere in the world. But the downside is that however weird or extreme your views are, you can find somewhere in the world people who share them. And therefore you can have a network of people who reinforce each other's views in an echo chamber. I mean, I think I first learned about this in a book by David Brin many years ago. He talked about this, and it's a well-known characteristic. And it's very hard to know how we can deal with this. Obviously, one can monitor extremism, and I know that the big companies have thousands of people who are monitoring the content, but I think this is a consequence of our interconnected world. Our world is far more interconnected in every possible way, just-in-time delivery, financial systems, transport and everything else, and this has advantages in promoting contacts across national boundaries, but disadvantages in that you don't need to care about your immediate neighbours, who may be more normal, even if you are extreme, and so you don't have that stabilising effect in a small neighbourhood. And so I think there is an upside and there's a downside. One consequence, incidentally, in my book, when I do talk about disasters, is that unlike in the old days, any kind of disaster can't be limited to one continent. It'll spread globally because we are so interconnected. And also, I think we are, in our society, more brittle. To give an example of that, suppose there were a natural pandemic, something like bubonic plague, which happened in the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, the Black Death killed half the population in many towns. The rest just went on resignedly and fatalistically. If we had a similar pandemic now, then I think well before the number of cases had reached 1% of the population, there'd be social breakdown, because that would overwhelm the capacity of hospitals. And once people knew that they weren't getting access to treatment, then I think there'd be social breakdown, just as there would be if the electricity grid was shut down for a week or so. So we are so dependent on modern technology, expectations are so high, that social breakdown is far more likely to happen in the face of a disaster than it would have been in the Middle Ages, where people were fatalistic and their expectations were so low.
Right. And United Nations projections say that the African population alone will be 4 billion by the end of this century. Nigeria alone will have a population of 900 million, which, as you point out in your book, will be equal to Europe and North America combined. Talk about the implications of that and what solutions you explore.
Well, let me say that population projections until 2050 are fairly reliable. I think we can predict that, barring some massive disaster, the population of the world by 2050 will be about 9 billion. And we can say that because most of the people in the world now are young. They're in the developing world where the population has been rising fast, and they will have a longer life expectancy and they'll have their children. So 9 billion by mid-century we can predict. We can't predict beyond that time, because that will depend on decisions made by people as yet unborn of how many children they have. But there are projections where, in Africa, for instance, if the number of children per woman remains high, the population could double again from 2 billion to 4 billion between 2050 and 2100. That's what would lead to the figures you've just quoted. We don't know whether that would happen. I think in everyone's interest, especially those of Africa, one would hope that that doesn't happen and that the population does stabilize.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
Right. So you praise companies like, you know, the population explosion is going to have implications for our food supply. Mm-hmm. You praise companies like Impossible Foods here in Silicon Valley. They make a meatless burger. What other innovations here and around the world have you, would you cite as making a substantive impact to that search for food solutions?
Well, I think if we can't have 9 billion people all living in the same way as most of us here do, using as much energy and eating as much beef. But we can, on the other hand, have a world in which 9 billion people live a good life if they perhaps have a slightly different diet and use energy more efficiently, and we have clean energy. And I would say that one of the technologies that is extremely benign is artificial meat. Of course, what we now have is, as it were, rather low-tech artificial meat, but the idea of growing meat from a single cell is something which is being discussed, and I think that sort of thing would be hugely beneficial for the world, and also other ways in which we can grow food for 9 billion people without using up all the world's landmass, because there's also the issue that we want to preserve as much wild land, because another of our obligations to future generations is surely to not leave a depleted world a less biodiverse world. And of course, to quote the great ecologist E.O. Wilson, if our generation causes mass extinctions, it's a sin that future generations will least forgive us for. And to avoid causing mass extinctions, we've got to leave plenty of wild land and not take it all over for food growing or indeed for biofuels either.
Right. In your chapter on biotech and bioterror threats, you write about the growing risks of pandemics.
Yes.
You say the global village will have its village idiots, and they'll have global range. Can you spell out what risks you envision there?
Going back to what I said earlier, I think it is possible for people to generate a virus which is more virulent and more transmissible than a natural one. This was done in 2012 for the influenza virus by a group in Wisconsin, as I mentioned. This sort of thing can be done. Now, of course, by error or by design, something like this could be released it could be catastrophic. I think, of course, an organized terrorist group or government doesn't use bioweapons simply because the effect is so unpredictable. So my worst nightmare is actually of an ecology fanatic who thinks the world is being polluted by too many human beings and would be happy to reduce their number and wouldn't care who or how. And someone like that with access to biotech could of course engender a pandemic. And I think if we think about the consequences of biotechnology, there has of course been a lot of effort in the last two or three years to devise regulations for technologies like the gain-of-function experiments on viruses or CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing, to regulate them on grounds of prudence and on grounds of ethics. And it's right this should be done, and I know our Royal Society and National Academy is doing this sort of thing. But it's going to be hard to enforce these regulations. And my worry, and why I said right at the beginning that my worry was about biotech, is that to create some dangerous biotech scenario can be done by millions of people with the expertise using laboratory facilities which exist in many universities and many companies. It's not like building a nuclear bomb, which takes huge special facilities. And my worry is that now we have many, many countries in the world where this can be done, and we have strong commercial pressures for doing it first. And my worry is that even if we have, as I hope we will have, regulations which enforce the regulations which suggest what should and shouldn't be done in biotech, enforcing those globally will be as hopeless as enforcing the drug laws globally or the tax laws globally. And whatever can be done will be done by someone somewhere. And that's what scares me. We've already seen a minor version of this with the Chinese work on human embryos a month or so ago. There'll be mega versions of that, and I don't see any way in which we can eliminate them, because it's so impossible to police people in the necessary detail.
So you condemn that scientist in China who's done that work on using CRISPR technology?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't do that, but I think he is generally condemned by his colleagues. Not just in the West, but in China too, for doing something where the risk-benefit analysis didn't justify it. I mean, I think CRISPR-Cas9 has been used beneficially to remove the single genes which cause diseases like Huntington's disease. And I think people think that there the benefits justify it. But in this case, he was causing a risky change in the genome, and the alleged benefit was to make the child less susceptible to HIV. And I think even a Chinese scientist didn't think that was the right balance.
Right. And there's been talk that he will get the death penalty. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's over the top.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. It seems extreme.
Yeah. Is that really talked about?
That's what I've heard. That's what I've read. The Economist this week had a lead story about China's growing dominance in science.
Yes.
It says, the looming prospect of a dominant rule-breaking high-tech China alarms Western politicians. Should the world worry, and should we?
Well, it's not clear they'll break the rules any more than the West will. I mean, I think this example has been condemned by a Chinese scientist, but I think it is clear that the four centuries of dominance of the North Atlantic, Europe and the US, is going to change, because it's going to be in East Asia where the human capital is going to be concentrated in the next 50 years, and the financial capital. So I think it is natural that the dominant scientific power will be China and East Asia. And we shouldn't deplore that. That's where the population is. It's not a zero-sum game. The more people we have doing these things, the better. So I think it's realistic to expect that China is going to be the dominant power 50 years from now. We shouldn't deplore this. It's inevitable, and it's not a zero-sum game.
Okay, I thought you would think that. So let's talk about artificial intelligence. Elon Musk and others, including your late colleague Stephen Hawking, have warned nothing will affect the future of humanity more than the digital superintelligence, not even nuclear threats. What is your view?
Well, it's certainly a risk. We've all read these scenarios. I mean, I personally am slightly more relaxed. I think in the short run, we have the redistribution of the labor force, which I mentioned already, due to AI. And I think AI has done these wonderful things, the capacity to learn to play chess as well as a world champion, just been given the rules in 3 hours. This is really wonderful. This technology, I think, can be used in many benign ways. I mean, I hope it'll help physicists to understand string theory better and see if it's right, for instance, and make other developments in science. I think there's one short-term concern also, which is that we will have these algorithms which are generally reliable, and we won't know exactly how they work, just like the program that played Go or played chess as well as a human, made surprising moves, and the programmers don't know how it made those decisions. And I think there is a short-term ethical issue that if something's going to happen to us, whether we're going to be sent to prison, deprived of credit, or recommended for a surgical operation, it's not enough for us to be told that this is a decision of an algorithm which is generally very reliable. We would like to feel that we can contest the decision and be given a reason. And I think it'll be unfortunate if we are controlled by these. That's a short-term threat. The long-term threat you mentioned is of a machine getting out of its box and affecting the world through the Internet of Things perhaps being superhuman in its capabilities. All-round capabilities. And, of course, some people believe this. At one extreme, there's a Ray Kurzweil who works at Google who thinks that within 30 years we'll have this so-called singularity where the machines take over. At the other extreme, there's a Rodney Brooks at Harvard. He's the inventor of the Baxter robot and the Roomba vacuum cleaner. He's of the other extreme. He thinks we'll never have this, and he thinks that we'll always have to worry less about artificial intelligence and about real stupidity. And that whether he's right or not, I don't know. I'm somewhere in between, but I think we do have to worry about the social impacts of machines and not leave too many decisions to them if we can't understand their reasoning, because there could be all kinds of hidden bugs which we can't understand. And this has emerged in many cases when they've tried to use algorithms.
Right. So Elon Musk is backing Neuralink, which I'm sure you've heard of, a Silicon Valley company creating devices that can be implanted in the human brain to help us merge with software and keep pace with advancements in artificial intelligence. They say it could improve memory and allow for more direct connection with computers. What are your thoughts and concerns on that?
Well, if you were right, that would be great in a way. But since you've mentioned this, let me discuss one chapter in my book which involves Elon Musk and space. Elon Musk, of course, is an advocate of manned space flight and going to Mars. And he has said he wants to die on Mars, but not on impact. And that's fine. I would say that as far as manned spaceflight is concerned, if I was an American, I wouldn't support the NASA manned program at all. I'd leave it to the private sector. They could do it more cheaply because they can accept higher risks than NASA can impose on publicly funded civilians. So I would leave it to the private sector, because the case for humans is no longer a practical case. Robots can do what humans could do. It's simply an adventure to send humans into space now, and it should be left to risk takers, like the guy Baumgartner who fell supersonically from a high-altitude balloon. People like that, prepared to take high risk. We should cheer them on. And they will set up on Mars. Now, if we imagine that by the end of a century there's a community of people on Mars, all crazy people like that, probably, then they will, of course, be away from all the regulators, who I discussed, who will regulate biotech. And so they will be able to use all the techniques we'll then have of genetic modification and maybe cyborg addition, which is nice, to adapt to an alien environment. Because whereas we're fairly well adapted living on the Earth, those people would be ill adapted to Mars. So I think the transhuman era is going to start with those people who go to Mars. And they will perhaps eventually download themselves and into something entirely electronic. And if that happens, then they won't want to be on a planet at all. They won't need an atmosphere. They may prefer zero gravity, and so they'll go off. And if they're near immortal, then they can go to the stars. So I think if you think of the long-range future, it'll be electronic entities which will spread far beyond our solar system. And the trigger for all that could be these people who go to Mars, because they will have the incentive to use all these new technologies quickly. And so we should cheer them on, even though there won't be mass immigration. What I disagree with Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking about is the idea of mass immigration. I think it's absurd to think we can escape the world's problems by going to Mars. It's a dangerous delusion, in fact, because dealing with climate change, which we discussed, is difficult, but it's a doddle compared to terraforming Mars. And living on Mars is worse than living at the South Pole or the top of Everest. So I think the idea of mass emigration is not a plausible or desirable one.
Right. So British entrepreneur Richard Branson is focusing on space tourism, but you say that term should be avoided. Why is that?
Well, I think the word tourism implies that it's safe, and then the first accident will cause a trauma, because the problem with the American shuttle was it was presented as safe, and they launched the school teacher, Ms. McAuliffe, who was killed, etc. And so each of the two accidents in the shuttle was a national trauma and delayed them for 3 years. If they'd said, this is high risk, these are test pilots taking high risks, then a less than 2% failure rate, two crashes out of 135 launches, would have been accepted. So using the word tourism implies it's safe. And that's why I'm saying that the phrase space adventure should be used. We should accept that the people going into space are taking very high risks. They're the kind of people who are prepared to do that sort of thing.
Right. So let's focus on your specialist subject for a few moments here.
Yes, yes.
You argue that astronomy is the first science to do more good than harm to our daily, everyday lives, more than medicine.
I think what I actually said was that the astronomy is the oldest science except perhaps for medicine and the first to do more good than harm, because early medicine probably did more harm than good, whereas in developing the calendar and navigation, astronomy did good certainly from the 15th century onwards. So that's what I meant. But I think it's my favourite science, naturally, but I think it's a very special science because it's the most universal science. It's a fundamental science, but it's the grandest environmental science as well, because everyone throughout history has looked up at the same sky, the same sort of vault of heaven, and wondered about it in their own way. So it's the most universal science, and just as all science brings people together, straddles all boundaries of nations and faith, astronomy does this more than any other, I think. And moreover, it's a very exciting subject where the discoveries can be explained to a wide audience. They're not too specialized. And for instance, if you look at what's happened in the last few years, realizing that every star in the sky is surrounded by a retinue of planets, just as the sun is surrounded by the Earth and the familiar planets, this makes the night sky far more interesting, far more mysterious, and we now can really try to answer the question, is there life out there? Is intelligent life even? And what will we do if we discover it? So it's a wonderful subject for those of us who are privileged to do it, but also it's a subject which appeals to everyone and is part of a tradition that dates back for centuries.
Great. So I've got a bunch of audience questions here. Mm-hmm. They could be a bit random, but I will jump in. One audience member is concerned about all these challenges we're facing, and our governments are becoming more isolationists. Can you talk about this trend and efforts to tackle these issues like climate change and how we can perhaps help reverse this isolationist stance? Do you have any hope for that?
Well, of course, it's this country in particular which is going more isolationist, so I wouldn't venture to comment on American politics.
Go on.
No, I won't. yes, but I think it is true that some topics need international collaboration. I mean, we have the International Atomic Energy Agency, the World Health Organization, which can identify a pandemic starting on a Vietnamese farm, for instance, and we have other international bodies, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and we may need more like that. So we do need more organizations to span different nationalities. So I would certainly agree with that, and that combats isolationism. So the things that nation states can do are getting more limited. But on the other hand, when we talk about space, often people talk in a grand way, saying we are going to go to the Mars, etc. like that. But space exploration doesn't have to be a big national goal. It was done for purposes of national pride, of course, in the Apollo era, but that can be left to private sector. We don't all have to decide whether to go to Mars or not. Some people may want to, and good luck to them. So we don't need to do everything in a public sector way in a national scale, but some things we clearly do.
Right. Another audience question. Aren't you worried that nuclear power, if proliferated in as alternative energy sources, might fall into the wrong hands, i.e. hostile governments, transnational militants, and extreme groups?
Well, I am worried, but I mentioned the International Atomic Energy Agency, which does a good job. It may need to be beefed up in order to cope with these risks. But it's much easier to monitor nuclear power stations than to monitor what someone does in a university lab in the biotech area. So I think it is feasible to monitor nuclear power. But I also think that if we have new kinds of nuclear power generators which are safer and more standardized and cheaper, then that will also ease the situation. So I'm not too worried about that.
Right. Going back to astronomy and the existence of life on other planets, talk about recent findings on Mars, signs of water, and what is the implication of that?
Well, of course, the implication is that there might have been some simple life on Mars, the probes that are now surveying the surface of Mars may find some evidence for that. And in our solar system, there may be some life under the ice of Europa, a moon of Jupiter, or Enceladus, a moon of Saturn. Some people think there might be life in the upper atmosphere of Venus, where the temperature is not so high as lower down. So there are places where there might be simple life. But of course, no one thinks there's going to be any sort of complex or advanced life in our solar system. That's why it's so exciting to have found that there are probably a million planets like the Earth orbiting other stars in our galaxy, and to ask whether any of them would have evolved life to at least the extent that has happened on the Earth. And we will know the answer to that in 20 years' time from the next generation of big telescopes.
It's exciting. Mm-hmm. In your chapter, Humanity in a Cosmic Perspective, you write poetically, we are literally the ashes of long-dead stars. Mm. Can you explain that?
Yes, I can explain. The early universe just contained basically hydrogen and helium, and stars are fueled by nuclear fusion, which turns helium into carbon, then oxygen, and up the periodic table as far as iron. And when stars die, they blow out in a supernova all that debris. It goes into interstellar space, and then recondenses new stars. So the Sun is a second-generation star which condensed from gas already contaminated by debris from stars that had already lived and died. So the Sun is a sort of second- or third-generation star, and the Earth has the same composition as the Sun. So we contain in our bodies atoms which were made before the solar system formed, and indeed probably come from many hundreds of different stellar explosions all around the galaxy. So we are, in a sense, linked to the stars in a more intimate way than the astrologers ever realized.
It's quite poetic. Yeah. How concerned should we all be about an asteroid destroying Earth?
I would say not very. I mean, it's the one risk that we can quantify. We know how many asteroids there are, we know the probabilities, and we can calculate this risk. It's not zero, and indeed there are, as you probably know, efforts to monitor all the asteroids that above 50 meters across that might cross the Earth, and it should be feasible to actually nudge the orbits to deflect those that might. So it's worthwhile trying to reduce the threat. But the reason I didn't worry too much is that the risk of an asteroid impact is not getting any higher. It was a risk for the dinosaurs, of course, and it would be a risk for the Neanderthals, but it's no higher. Whereas the risks that I worry most about, which I've discussed in my book and we've talked a bit about, are those which are newly emergent as a consequence of humanity's actions, our collective actions on the planet's environment, or our individual actions misusing powerful technology. And these risks are growing all the time, and we don't have a long time base to make us confident that we can survive them. And so these are, I think, the main concerns. They're far larger, just like the risk of a nuclear war in the last 40 years has been far, far higher than the risk of an asteroid impact. And we have these new ones stemming from 21st century technology. And so they're the ones I worry about. Asteroids, I think, are not so serious.
Okay, so we can all sleep.
Although we can do something to reduce them. It's worth doing that.
Right. So in the last years in astronomy, there have been quite a few highlights. For example, the detection of gravitational waves, mm-hmm. more understanding of exoplanets. And you write in your book that was facilitated by two big developments, more powerful telescopes on the ground and in space, and better computers.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on what's exciting for the next 5 years?
Far more studies of how galaxies form, far more studies of exoplanets using bigger telescopes. The Europeans are building a telescope with a mirror 39 meters across. That's probably almost twice the width of this room. And that'll really be able to make a big leap forward on this. So I think better observations will help in astronomy. But also, you mentioned computers, and of course, we can't do experiments in astronomy. We can just observe. But we can, in the virtual world of our computer, do experiments. We can crash two galaxies together in a computer simulation and see what happens, and do this making various different assumptions and seeing which fits the observations best. So the way we improve our theories is by doing lots of options and seeing which matches the data. And computer power is improving so fast, we can now do more realistic simulations. I mean, for a long time, aeronautical engineers have not used wind tunnels. They've computed the flow of gas around aerofoils, etc. Whereas now we can compute how stars explode, how they collide, and things like that, and get models which are good enough to compare with the data and test whether we've got the right ideas or not. So that's why computer simulators are especially important in astronomy, because we can't do any real real experiments, just observations.
Right. So in your TED Talk, Martin, you mentioned that your last book, Our Final Century, was retitled for the American public as Our Final Hour, underlining our instant gratification mindset. Talk about mindset and the importance. That seems to be an overarching theme in your book.
Yes.
About the importance of changing our mindset and having a longer-term, more global mindset. What can we do to encourage that to happen?
It's true that we tend to be short-term. And in my book, I contrast a situation in medieval times when people thought the universe would only last another 1,000 years, but nonetheless, they built cathedrals which would not be finished in their lifetime. They planned 50 or 100 years ahead. Now, that at first seems paradoxical, but that's because although they thought there might be an apocalypse 1,000 years from now, they thought that their children and grandchildren would live in the same world as they did. They didn't expect there was rapid change from one generation to the next. Now things are quite different. We know that our Earth has been around for billions of years. It's existed for 45 million centuries, and this century is the first special one, which is the focus of my book, but it'll exist for 50 million centuries more before the sun flares up and dies. So we have this enormous time span in the future and in the past. Nonetheless, we can't foresee what things would be like for the next generation, whose technology is changing in a time scale of 20 or 30 years. So there's been this much greater disjunction between the time scale we can envisage overall and the time scale where we can plan. And I think that's a big problem. We sometimes do have to try and plan a bit further ahead. There's only one case where we do, and that's radioactive waste disposal, where we talk seriously about whether the deposit is safe for 10,000 years. In other cases, we don't plan more than 30 years ahead, and we need to at least have a longer horizon and realize that we benefit from the heritage left by people in earlier centuries, and we should not risk leaving a depleted world for future generations.
So, Martin Rees, we have time for just one last question. You've had a remarkable career and impact. What do you feel is your greatest achievement, and what do you want to be remembered for?
Well, there are many things I hope I'll be forgotten for. But to answer the question, I feel that two things. First, I've been fortunate to be involved in a subject during nearly 50 years now where there have been exciting developments, and I enjoy the fact that it's a social activity. One works with many colleagues, and the work one does is of interest not just to fellow specialists but to a wider public. And I think I've enjoyed being with the ringside seat, as it were, for the exciting developments. But also, I've been fortunate in having the chance to be involved through the Royal Society and other activities in understanding other sciences and science policy and the applications of science. And it's really those broader perspectives which have led me to write this book, which collects my thoughts on how science is impacting on the world. And just one final thought. I've talked about science, but there are many probably engineers here in the audience, and I include engineering and technology. And let me quote with a cartoon which my engineering friends like, and which has a certain truth in it. It shows a picture of two beavers looking up at a big hydroelectric dam. One beaver says to the other, "I didn't actually build it, but it's based on my idea." And that reflects, as engineers would agree, the balance of effort between the scientists who have the idea and the technologists and engineers who actually build something. And we need them both.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and by Wonderfest. Again, we would like to thank Dr. Martin Rees, Astronomer Royal, Alison von Dinkelen, BBC contributor, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio and by podcast. And now, this meeting is formally adjourned.